Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Diana, sitting in for Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services at santafe.radiocafe.org, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafemc. Today I'm talking with Janice Stout, the co-editor of a new book called The Selected Letters of Willa Cather, which was recently published by Knopf. Janice has written several books about Willa Cather. She's also an expert on Katherine Ann Porter, the writer, and she is a professor emerita at Texas A&M University. Good morning, Janice.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in. Your new book, The Selected Letters of Willa Cather, is a collection of more than 550 letters Cather wrote between 1888, when she was a teenager,
right,
and 1947, when she died.
Right.
And it's a pretty big deal in the literary world, because until now we haven't had access to her first-person letters.
Absolutely, absolutely. Scholars or other interested people could go to libraries if they could find where the letters were and could read them, but they could not be quoted under terms of her will and under U.S. copyright law.
How did this come about? How did you find a way to bring them to the public?
In 2011, her last named executor passed away, a very long-lived nephew. And the family then cooperated in setting up a trust between the University of Nebraska Foundation and the Willa Cather Foundation. And the trust very much wanted the letters to be published. And Andy Jewell and I had been working on them in another context for quite a while, so we were ready.
They weren't sitting all in one place originally, is that right?
That's right. There's something like 72 or 3 archives that have letters, maybe 2 letters, maybe 100 letters. I mean, they are scattered all over the country. And we know there are others that we don't know where they are right now, but we hope to find them.
When did you start looking for the letters?
I started in the early 90s when I was working on Willa Cather, the writer and her world. And I would go where I had seen suggestions that there were letters and transcribe them in my computer word by word. What a great advantage the computer gives us to do something like this. In the old days, somebody used a pencil and paper.
Did you carry your computer into libraries and research centers?
Yes, that is now standard practice.
Yeah. Wow. And you present them in the book in chronological order. And when you read the book, it's a very thick book. I don't know if I haven't read every letter, but I've read quite a great deal of them. And it reads like a biography.
We so hoped people would think that. We tried to keep a narrative thread going without having excess words of our own in there. We wanted the letters to tell a story, and I think they do.
And you provide a little bit of background, so when she's writing to, say, Alfred Knopf, you explain this as her publisher at the beginning, so we know who she's talking to.
Right.
And we really get a good idea of her personality.
I think so. Of course, any writer's novels or poems gives us insight into that writer's mind. But letters give so much more direct insight. And for one thing, we see Cather had a great sense of humor. I'm not sure you'd guess that from her books.
No.
Yeah.
Of course, her book, Death Comes for the Archbishop, is a beloved book here in New Mexico.
Right, absolutely. In most of the country, My Antonia would be the one people immediately thought of. But here, people think of Archbishop, yes.
And I often think of her as a New Mexico writer, but I'm incorrect. She grew up in Nebraska, correct?
That's right. She was born in Virginia, and at the age of 9, she was moved to Nebraska when her family went, and she thought she would die on the prairies, but then she came to love them. But it was in 1912. I would have to add up real quick as to how old she was. Born in 73, so. She was like 37.
Mm-hmm.
She came out to the Southwest to get a little rest and relaxation. She'd been a very successful editor of McClure's magazine. This was a very big deal then. And she was living in New York, working in New York, and she was just burned out. So she came to the Southwest to visit a brother, first in Winslow, Arizona, where he was working with the railway. And then they traveled around a bit, the Grand Canyon, New Mexico. And, oh, she fell in love with New Mexico.
And this was really the frontier in those days?
Sure, absolutely it was. But already people were looking to this area for an artistic and a literary retreat. And in fact, some of the liveliest letters in here are addressed to a friend of hers who was also a writer and a journalist who was thinking about coming to the Southwest herself. So Cather keeps saying things like, I think I could write in Albuquerque. I think you could write in Albuquerque. And indeed, Elizabeth Sargent, to whom she was writing, did come live in New Mexico.
I noticed that in a lot of her letters she says, I'm looking for the perfect place to write, somewhere quiet, somewhere I can have quiet time and be inspired by the landscape. And she was inspired by our landscape and history.
Yes, very much. She was very sensitive to place, to landscape. Wherever she was, a landscape was either right for her or it was not right for her. And she did find New Mexico right.
Where did she spend time here, in Taos?
She visited in Taos several times with Mabel Dodge Lujan. She stayed in Lamy for weeks at a certain little hotel there. She stayed at the San Gabriel Ranch, which is near Española. But I think in Santa Fe was her main place that she liked to come.
And she did stay at La Fonda.
She did. That's where she was staying when she found this book about Father Mashabuff, who is like the Archbishop number two man, number one man, his right-hand man, that's what I want to say. And that just crystallized her wish to write a book about the area.
And her book, Death Comes for the Archbishop, is not the only book that was inspired by the Southwest, is that correct?
That's correct. She had earlier written The Song of the Lark, which is about a young woman's growth into the stature of a real artist, an opera singer. And there's a big central section there that is based in Walnut Canyon, which is over near Flagstaff. Mm-hmm. Although in the book it's not called Walnut Canyon, it's Panther Canyon. I have no idea why she made the change. But also the professor's house has a big central section around Mesa Verde. So this whole area of the country she was very drawn to. Yeah.
She wrote Death Comes for the Archbishop in which year, 1927?
It was published in 27, yes. She had started on it in 25 and begun to shape it out. And I would sort of like to read you a letter she wrote in 26, if that's okay.
Please do.
This was written on April 25th, 1926, when she was hard at work on Death Comes for the Archbishop, and she wrote to her agent, Paul Reynolds. This story is not a love story any more than Robinson Crusoe is. It is simply not that sort of story at all. It's concerned with the picturesque conditions of life in the Southwest, just at the time New Mexico was taken over from Old Mexico. Let me break in to say that I think that phrase, taken over, shows that she had a pretty good grasp of history. And with the experience of two Catholic missionaries who were sent there to bring order out of the mixture of Indian and Spanish and Mexican superstitions, a term that makes us wince, I think. The real hero of the story is Father Latour. His real name was Lamy, the young Frenchman who was made Bishop of New Mexico at the age of 37, a man of old and noble family. He was finally made an archbishop and died in Santa Fe in 1886. In other words, he went there in the days of the Buffalo and Indian massacres, and he lived to see the Santa Fe Railroad cross New Mexico. So you see, this book is very rooted in history.
Very much so. And at the time, it was not immediately considered a standard novel. Is that right?
Well, at least some critics questioned whether it ought to be called a novel. And Cather herself, who was perhaps a more experimental modernist writer than people sometimes think, questioned whether it should be called a novel. She wrote a friend shortly after it was published, "Just what is a novel, I wonder? For myself, I would rather call it a narrative and just not pin that label on it." Yeah.
How was the book received at first?
It was received with great enthusiasm, even though there were these questions about, gee, is it really a novel or isn't it a novel? These were asked about some of her other books, so that wasn't a great surprise. But people at once began to perceive it as a wonderful, wonderful book, especially people in the Catholic Church. She received many letters from priests, from nuns, from lay Catholics, saying what a wonderful book it was, how it captured the beauty of their faith, and they assumed she was Catholic. She was not.
She was not. She was Protestant?
She was Protestant. She had first been a Baptist, and then in 1928, a year after Archbishop was published, she and her family joined the Episcopal Church in Red Cloud, Nebraska. But no, she was never a Catholic. She said once, many years after the book came out, that she would have written about the Southwest sooner, except she thought no Protestant could handle the material of the church in the Southwest properly. But then nobody who was Catholic came along and did it, and so she did it herself. I'm not quite sure how much credence to put in that. But at any rate, that's what she said.
And she does show a great deal of respect and interest and love for the Catholic culture here.
She absolutely does. She certainly admired the priests who came from Europe after this area became part of the United States. And I think she accepted the belief that Catholic practices before that were not really authentic. You know, Archbishop Lamy did, shall we say, regularize Catholic practices here, or he attempted to. Again, I don't know that that's something we're entirely comfortable with, but Cather was, and she did admire the French priests who came into this area.
And it was a different time when she was alive and processing all this information, so...
Absolutely. We have now what some people call revisionist history, and we go back and ask questions that maybe she wasn't asking then. But it is a beautiful book, and I think the scene when the Archbishop goes into the church on a cold winter night and finds there a poor, virtually enslaved woman who has come to take solace in the church, it's a beautiful scene.
It's a special book, as I said, for all of us here. One of the first ones I read when I moved here, and I think a lot of people might do the same thing.
Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about, there's a bit of the controversy, perhaps, mm-hmm. with publishing these letters that Willa Cather wrote. She died asking that her letters be destroyed, is that correct?
Well, at least she said she wanted them not to be published.
Okay.
And some people who wrote, who corresponded with her, understood that she wanted them to be destroyed, but apparently not everybody understood it that way, because her family kept letters and they have donated them now for use, and they have been at meetings celebrating this book of letters. But it's true, in her will, which was made in 1943, she said that the letters should not be published, but she would leave it to her executors whether to enforce that or not. Not quite sure what that means. Leave it to them whether to file a lawsuit if somebody did. I mean, it's hard to know. There was never any legal action taken. But when the last of her executors, her named executors, passed away in 2011, then the family cooperated in establishing a trust that is now the executor. And this trust very much approved publishing the letters. I think they knew that the availability of these letters could only enhance Cather's reputation.
And you'd been working on collecting them before this happened.
For a long time, from the early 90s, I was collecting and transcribing letters for use in a book that I was writing, but I couldn't quote them because it was still unacceptable. You can always paraphrase in your own words to indicate what's in a letter. That is always permissible. No problem. But there is the problem that it doesn't capture the author's words. If it's a paraphrase, it's not the author's own words. And the own words are the only thing that really express her intention. So I was glad to be able to use these for research, but that's not at all the same as having the letters.
Yes. Did the family or the trust have final say before the book was published? Did they read it?
They had a summary of what would be in the book. I don't know if they read proofs before it actually came out or not. I really don't. That's a good question.
And have they been happy?
They have been very happy, and they absolutely approved. And we could not have published the book. Knopf wouldn't have let us in the door if the trust had not approved publishing the letter. Yeah. And let me say, Andy and I were so happy that Knopf wanted to do it, because that was Cather's own chosen publisher. At first she was with Houghton Mifflin, but she switched to Knopf and never budged for the rest of her career.
I enjoyed reading the letters she wrote to Alfred Knopf himself in your collection.
Right. There are some wonderful letters, and some of those we didn't know about until very shortly before we finished the book. They were located at a foundation in New York City, and my co-editor went there and transcribed them.
And your co-editor, of course, is Andrew Jewell.
Right.
He is of the University of Nebraska.
Yes, he is. He's in the library and in the English department there, and he heads up the Cather Project, which includes maintaining papers, putting papers up online. He's very involved in Cather studies. And he's quite a young man, but he has lots of experience nevertheless.
Is the University of Nebraska the main repository for her works and
that
letters?
That is indeed the main one, but the Willa Cather Foundation and the Historical Society have quite a few. The Historical Society is in Lincoln, where the university is. The foundation offices are in Red Cloud, so to read those letters, you go to Red Cloud, where she grew up. The J. Pierpont Morgan Library in New York has a big collection. The University of Vermont has a pretty big collection, because that's where Dorothy Canfield's papers are. So they are really scattered.
And Willa Cather traveled a lot.
She did.
Was that unusual at the time? I was surprised at how much she traveled, but maybe it wasn't so strange.
Oh, I don't really think so. People who had the means to travel were very interested in going to Europe. Americans had been wanting to go to Europe since at least the mid-1800s, so that was not very unusual. It was unusual for her. She hadn't had the money until she had been out of college and working a few years and saving up money, and she finally got to go to Europe in 1902. She traveled in Europe a lot. She traveled on this continent a lot. She fell in love also with Quebec and wrote a novel set in Quebec.
What was that called?
That's called Shadows on the Rock. And not everybody likes that novel very much. It's very quiet. It doesn't have a lot of action. But on the other hand, there are people who love it above all the others. So.
And she won the Pulitzer Prize for
One of Ours, which was a war novel, really, a World War I novel. The story was based very largely on a cousin of hers in Nebraska who had had trouble finding himself, and he finally signed up and went off to Europe in the war effort and succeeded in being regarded as a very fine officer. He was killed in battle. And as soon as she found out about his death, she began preparing this novel. Some of the men in literature made fun of her. Ernest Hemingway made fun of her. She had to get her war knowledge out of a book. She probably got it from the movie The Birth of a Nation. I think many people felt that a woman had no business writing about war. But World War I really changed that. A lot of women poets, as well as memoir writers, wrote about the war, and Willa Cather did too. She won the Pulitzer for that book.
Well, Willa Cather's books are available, as is your book, The Selected Letters of Willa Cather, at many bookstores, but
right.
Especially here at Collected Works, where you spoke last night.
Right.
To a crowd of Willa Cather fans.
They were a terrific crowd, too.
Yeah. We have our Willa Cather followers here in Santa Fe, so I'm sure I'm glad to have you here, and I know they were glad to have you here, too. I hope our listeners were happy to hear you this morning.
I hope so.
Once again, The Selected Letters of Willa Cather, published by Knopf and written by Janice Stout. Thank you so much for being here.
A great pleasure.
And I hope you have a good stay in Santa Fe.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Rob DeWalt, and we'll be talking about Speaking of the Arts, as is our Friday morning tradition. So please stay with us.